Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Please, guys, let's make a deal.
Behind one door, there's 1,000 in cash. Behind another door, there's 2,000. Behind the third door, there's 20,000. If you go for it, you're risking it all. So what's it going to be?
On Capitol Hill, there's only door number one, and you don't have a choice in the matter. There's not even a Monty Hall game show called Washington. You're the contestant, and there's no prize. Let's play. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Friday, September 26th. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Adora.
We are going to Capitol Hill to get the latest on the unfolding drama between Democrats and Republicans and the White House as lawmakers try to make a deal on the rescue plan for Wall Street. Meanwhile, the latest casualty, Washington Mutual Bank. It's the largest bank failure in U.S. history. Also today, a report on the war on terror in Pakistan and the scheduled presidential debates tonight. Will it happen? What should we be looking for if it does. Those stories are coming up, but first, here are some headlines.
You might call it an arranged marriage, or you might not. The Federal Reserve seized the assets of Washington Mutual and sold them to J.P. Morgan Chase for nearly $2 billion. The details basically outline the largest bank failure in U.S. history, but it won't change much for WAMU customers, at least at this point. Another day, more heated debate on Capitol Hill over the White House's proposed bailout of Wall Street. Democrat Barney Frank, the chair of the House Financial Services Committee, says they're still trying.
We are responding, I think, to the central thrust of that request, but adding collectively a number of things that will make people legitimately feel better.
That's behind door number one. But this holdup now appears to be with key GOP lawmakers. They say the government shouldn't buy bad debt. They would prefer tax breaks and a new government-backed insurance program like the FDIC. Negotiations will resume today.
The financial standoff has tonight's first presidential debate on hold. Barack Obama says he plans to show up at the University of Mississippi today, but John McCain would not comment, saying the massive financial bailout plan comes first. The federal corruption trial of Alaska Senator Ted Stevens is underway. His attorney says Stevens was just clueless about the cost and scope of a pricey makeover for his cabin. Prosecutors say he knew better and lied on Senate financial disclosure forms.
In Cologne, Germany, interesting terrorist story. State police say a special commando unit stormed a flight early today and arrested two suspects. News reports say the men left a note. They wanted to die for the jihad. Pakistan's new president, Zardari, told the UN General Assembly yesterday his country can't allow its territory to be violated even by its friends. It was a reference to disputes between U.S. soldiers and Pakistani troops on the border there in a tense standoff with Pakistani troops and the war in Afghanistan. Oil prices fell a little below $107. The S&P up nearly 2% yesterday, poised to open lower this morning. Also, the Dow Jones Industrial Average market's not happy at uncertainty in Washington. How are you feeling about it?
Yeah, how are you feeling? Are there any WAMU ATMs near you? Is this something that you're worried about? Does it affect you? Give us your take.
877-8-MY-TAKE or my take at thetakeaway.org. And also, you know, if John McCain doesn't show up, would you like to debate Barack Obama? Call us. 877-8-MY-TAKE for debaters. Debaters wanted here at The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. And by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Hey there, history buffs. Good morning. In 1906, you may remember J.P. Morgan, the banker, literally bailed out the U.S. economy by writing a check. If you woke up this morning as a Washington Mutual customer, wrong again. J.P. Morgan has bailed you out personally. You're now banking with J.P. Morgan Chase. It was the largest bank failure in U.S. history. It happened overnight. We'll have more details on that in a moment. But first, what's the name of that TV show, that other TV show, Deal or No Deal?
We believe that we're prepared to act expeditiously on a package to our colleagues that will allow us to send a message to the markets that the Congress heard the message.
We haven't gotten an agreement. There's still a lot of different opinions. Mine is it's flawed from the beginning.
I think I'm going with no deal. That's Richard Shelby, the senator, and Senator Chris Dodd speaking at odds on whether there is a deal today. It doesn't look like it yet. 6 days of bare-knuckled negotiations to bail out Wall Street. No ink on paper. No actual deal on the $700 billion bailout. What we do know is there's lots of drama behind the scenes, reports of begging on the part of the Treasury Secretary, verbal brawls. Joining us now is New York Times reporter David Herzenhorn. David, first the drama, please.
It's there's a lot of drama. It was a pretty wild day in Washington, and I think what you're seeing is what Washington looks like when everybody is just about to do something that nobody wants to do and nobody wants to own.
And in the middle of an election year, by the way.
And that's right. So everybody has to look like they're really reluctant, and there's no question they've put on a pretty good show of that. And I think what you'll see is everybody start moving from exactly what you said, which is no deal, very quickly to deal, because we're not hearing that they have many other alternatives out there.
And indeed, the markets overnight are reacting to all of this drama. The Dow futures are way down. We expect a lower open this morning on Wall Street, and Asian markets aren't terribly happy with what's going on. Overnight, Washington Mutual became the largest bank failure in U.S. history. That has to be on the minds of lawmakers as they get up today and try to tackle this again, right?
Oh, there's no question. And the market is going to send a loud and angry message that that as much as Washington may not be happy about taking ownership of this rescue package, that uncertainty is the thing that Wall Street and markets hate the most. And, you know, really it's a lot of jockeying that's going on. But you don't really hear people offering up anything other than some version of the core rescue proposal that the Bush administration put forward.
So we really don't know the details at this point. I mean, as of yesterday, they were saying there is going to be some sort of issue on compensation, and we were even hearing details late yesterday that this Senator Chuck Schumer idea of something on the order of an installment plan in $250 billion increments, that was actually on the table or part of the agreement. What do you know at this point?
I think actually we do know quite a bit of detail. It's really just a question of everybody being able to hold their hands, hold their nose, and jump. You know, we know that there will be a massive government intervention to buy up distressed assets. The Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson has been pretty clear that there's nobody else out there. The private sector is not going to provide the kind of capital that's needed to get some of these securities that could be very, very valuable off the market essentially for a while, buy them, hold them, wait for real estate prices to stabilize. So what you're seeing is lawmakers coming together around the idea of, you know, well, $700 billion is really huge, and everybody knows they can't spend that all at once. So if they dole it out, you know, $350 billion at first with the next portion to follow, that wouldn't be too bad. There's pretty wide agreement that there will be limits on executive pay for firms that seek help from the government. The administration had already agreed to a very tight oversight board. They'd already agreed that the government would, as part of this, would have to do more to stop foreclosures for average Americans, which is at the root cause of some of the financial problems going on. So we actually are seeing the components of this coming together. There are some folks like Senator Shelby of Alabama who on principle are never going to be happy with this. They may vote.
Well, and David, I mean, the issue there is Shelby's rhetoric and all of this rhetoric coming out of Washington suggests that this is going to be the tone if there's actually debate on the floor for this resolution to become law. We can only imagine what the negotiations are going to be about trying to limit debate, because everyone's going to want to stand up and publicly hold their nose. David Herzenhorn, thanks so much for being with us.
You're welcome.
David Herzenhorn is a New York Times reporter on the case in Washington.
And opposition to the bailout plan is also coming from outside the Beltway. This week, over 100 academic economists signed a letter to Congress asking Congress to reconsider, saying the plan is a subsidy to investors at taxpayers' expense. Jeffrey Miron is among those who signed. He is a Harvard University economist, and he comes to us from Boston. Good morning.
Good morning.
So why is the bailout a bad idea?
I think it's a bad idea for two reasons. First of all, the basic situation, while serious, is not catastrophic, and if left to work itself out on its own, would lead to moderate costs and disruptions, but not catastrophe. So I don't think that we have a situation that calls for drastic action. Second, the bailout will do a couple of really bad things. First, it will transfer a huge amount of money from the taxpayers generally to people who made risky bets. That is, they issued all these securities and bought all these securities, which were highly risky, and it turned out, you know, not to be as valuable as they thought. So the bailout just pays them for having taken this huge bet and lost, but that's insane. That's a crazy kind of economic policy. We don't want to compensate people for taking excessive risk. That encourages the wrong kind of behavior in the economy. So it's two-pronged. One, the problem is not as bad as it's being made out to be, and two, this is a huge transfer in an inappropriate way.
What about the issue of ambiguity? That was highlighted also in that letter.
The ambiguity of what exactly this bailout plan is going to do, that's a really important point. There are so many details that nobody has thought through. There's so much potential for unintended consequences, for the amounts to be adjusted, for the kind of securities that are bought to be different than what's being described, for companies involved to strategically move their assets around, reshuffle things, engage in all sorts of accounting gimmickry so that they get to sell off whatever it is they don't want, completely independent of what makes good sense for the government to buy.
And so then what do you make of President Bush's argument that unless action is taken of this nature, then, I don't know, Armageddon?
I just think that it's an assertion that's not based on past experience or evidence. There's reason to think that first of all, what will happen is some of these companies will go bankrupt. But bankruptcy doesn't mean that a company ceases to exist. It means that it becomes owned by its creditors rather than being owned by its shareholders.
Well, Jeffrey, would you advocate in that regard maybe relaxation of capital rules for banks so that maybe they wouldn't have to put up capital to back these toxic securities and could survive, even though on paper they're looking pretty grim?
Yes, I think that actually makes some sense, and I don't think the capital requirements necessarily made good sense in the first place, so I would be happy to endorse loosening that and let the market decide, okay, what level of capital requirements is appropriate if they're going to be willing to hold the stock of such companies. And if they don't like those low levels of capital, then again, the companies will be forced into bankruptcy, but they will then continue to operate for the most part, but they'll be owned by different people, by their creditors rather than the stockholders, but they will continue to do a lot of what they currently do. So the notion that all mortgage lending will just cease seems to be a huge exaggeration. There will be some disruption, no doubt. There may be some slowdown. There may be a recession. But I think that's far less than the Armageddon that people are trying to talk about. And it's far less serious than the negative consequences of getting the government involved in owning a huge fraction of one of the most important sectors of the economy.
Jeffrey, what do you make of this piece that was in the Journal yesterday? And, you know, we've heard reports of this all week of finance ministers all around the world saying, oh, look at you, America, you free marketeers, la, la, la. Now you're going to intervene bigger than we ever did before. What do you make of that?
Well, I think in a sense they have a good point. First of all, we haven't been free marketeers in this sector in several very important ways. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac were government-sponsored enterprises. They were empowered by government to do something very specific, to try to expand home ownership beyond a level that made good economic sense, and especially in the last 10 years or so, have extended a huge amount of subprime debt. What is that subprime debt? It means loans to borrowers who had terrible credit histories, and that came from government pressure on Fannie and Freddie. That's not free market economics. That is a huge amount of government intervention. So on the one hand, we haven't been practicing free market capitalism, but certainly they're right to make fun of us because we're getting bad results from our economic policies.
Jeffrey Miron, thank you. Jeffrey Miron is a Harvard University economist opposed to the bailout plan. being heatedly debated in Washington.
We want you to debate Barack Obama. If you want to get down to Mississippi, if McCain doesn't show up, give us a call, 877-8-MY-TAKE. We'll try to work it out for you, okay? Otherwise, give us your impressions of the bailout and how it's going to affect you. Washington Mutual no longer exists. It's part of J.P. Morgan Chase. If you're a WAMU customer, tell us what you think about it. 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. You know, I want to sort of go over for just a second. I don't know if you saw this, Adora, the details of the Washington Mutual seizure last night. I mean, you talk about drama on Capitol Hill. The board was in the air when the seizure took place. The chairman of the board, Alan Fishman, was actually flying from New York to Seattle by the time the deal was brokered. He landed at the airport and learned that he had no job.
You can't make this stuff up.
No. J.P. Morgan Chase will absorb $31 billion in losses that would normally have gone to the FDIC, that's the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. So basically, Washington, trying to negotiate this $700 billion deal for a bailout of Wall Street, realized that if WAMU failed, they suddenly were on the hook for $31 billion in losses, which they couldn't afford. So they seized WAMU and forced J.P. Morgan Chase to buy it. Very, very interesting side story that we'll have more details on as the morning proceeds. How do you like
I'm
that?
Speechless.
You're in the air and you land and they say, sir, you don't have a job.
The largest bank failure in U.S. history.
Certainly on the minds of American voters. Dante Cheney, who we've been checking in with all campaign long, is director of the Christian Science Monitor's Patchwork Nation Project. He's on the phone from Los Alamos, New Mexico. Dante, thanks for being with us.
No, thanks for having me on.
So each time we speak with you, we've been looking at the Patchwork Nation as a way of slicing and dicing the American electorate, but not using geography, actually using different kinds of categories, and also using these slices as a way of exploring issues. What's the slice you've got for us today?
Well, I thought we're going to talk about two today, which is the service worker centers. These are places that basically have a high number of people working service jobs in hotels, restaurants, the hardware store, wherever. And emptying nests. These are places where they have a lot of retirees and people on the verge of retirement, people living on fixed incomes.
People living on fixed incomes who spend their days watching the financial news channels and looking at the economy going up and down and up and down. I gather the economy is probably pretty important to these two groups.
Absolutely, and in different sorts of ways. But yeah, these are places, both kinds of places where the economy is a very, very big issue, and as you might imagine, the last couple of weeks it's really grown.
Well, let's listen to Ray Sanfratello, who's the president of the South Lake County Chamber of Commerce in Clermont, Florida, which is right outside of Orlando. I think it's safe to call him in the community of emptying nests.
I have a younger family, the kids in school. And we've had to cut back on a lot of what I guess you'd call discretionary expenses. Gas prices have climbed here exorbitantly, as they have around the rest of the country. So we don't make the trucks to Orlando like we had done in the past. We're curtailing our shopping. Opportunities to go out to local restaurants are limited.
There you have it in his voice, the ripples that are going through the economy as a result of this downturn and also a financial crisis. You know, we've heard, Dante, that or at least yesterday, Andrea Bernstein was saying that voters that she was talking to and the polls seem to suggest that as this economic story unfolds, it favors John McCain. It favors Barack Obama, and at the expense of John McCain, very, very significantly. What are you seeing?
Yeah, it's it's really interesting. It's doing this project and going around talking to these people, you hope you're getting some kind of representative sample. What we've seen this week, and I've been here in Los Alamos, and I've been down in El Mirage, Arizona, which is a place where it's a big immigrant community, and I've been watching the polls as you guys have, and there has just been a big switch that's gone on, and it seems to me in the last week or so, where a lot of undecideds are starting. Now, I don't know if it's permanent, but they're all starting to fall Obama's way, at least at the moment.
Would you say the economy is a blue issue at this point, or are there such things as red and blue issues as you see them on the Patchwork Nation quilt?
Well, yeah, red and blue issues that's a tough thing to call them. But I do think it's whatever you want to call it. It's something that's favoring Democrats right now, and obviously in large part because the Republicans are in power and Bush is in the White House, and people don't really think about the Congress. They think about the president as the person who has the power. And, he's taking the blame for this. I had a very interesting experience this week where I talked to somebody in Arizona who knows McCain personally and who has been to football games with McCain and obviously who lives in McCain's home state and was sure he was going to vote for McCain as this thing started. And he's not sure anymore.
Wow. Dante, listen to Kip Ward, who's the owner of the historic Anchor Inn in Lincoln City, Oregon, one of the service workers in the Patchwork Nation.
All the people that I talk to are more frightened than just concerned. At the start of the summer, we drove downtown and there was like two or three vacant store windows. And my wife and I, as we're driving downtown today, we counted 12 or 13, and that's a lot. And this is the tourist season. This is the time that people should be flourishing, not closing their doors. I really suspect that as the winter goes on, that 12 vacant buildings is going to expand.
Dante, it seems as though fear is motivating people, at least in what you're seeing, to make up their minds.
Yeah, and those service worker centers are particularly interesting because these are places where these are a lot of people living on the margins. They're not wealthy, and these aren't people who have a lot of money invested in the stock market. They don't even, a lot of them, have big 401ks or anything like that. But they're the ones who are they get the trickle down effect of the recession, and they're seeing it now.
Dante Cini, director of the Christian Science Monitor's Patchwork Nation Project, people reacting to the economy. What's your reaction?
I am a WAMU customer. At this point, I'm not too concerned, but I just want to know if maybe I should get the pension and other direct deposit checks diverted elsewhere. I'm calm now, but we'll see.
Washington Mutual depositor worried about the largest bank failure in U.S. history at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Now headlines from Richard Hake.
28 minutes past the hour, Washington Mutual was once the largest savings and loan bank in the U.S. Now it's the largest bank failure. J.P. Morgan Chase bought Washington Mutual last night for nearly $2 billion. Talks in Washington turned into a shouting match last night. Lawmakers clashed over the Bush administration's $700 billion bailout plan. The negotiations will resume this morning. Central banks in Europe are working with the Fed to pump funds into U.S. money markets. Now the Fed and global central banks can lend each other up to $300 billion. Yesterday, U.S. and Pakistani troops exchanged fire when a U.S. helicopter allegedly entered Pakistan's airspace. Now Pakistan's president says his troops fired warning flares, not gunshots. And finally, have you guys been following this Swiss adventurer who's trying to go across the English Channel?
On a jet wing.
Well, he just took off. He's trying to go from France to the White Cliffs of Dover. It's expected to take 12 minutes. It's a 22-mile trip, and he's airborne right now. And he's being filmed by the National Geographic Channel.
There he goes.
Those will be some interesting pictures.
So by the time I go out and come back in, we'll know if he made it or not.
All right, well, let's wish him luck.
Okay.
Thanks, Richard.
You're welcome.
Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, soliciting opinions about schools that offer cash rewards to students for improved grades and attendance records. Is it ethical? Is it like merit bonuses in business? Viewpoints at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. Well, if you go by the numbers, the economy is still growing. The GDP numbers are just out. The gross domestic product, the economy grew at a 2.8% pace in the spring, and that's the second quarter. That is that's lower than was estimated, but it still means we're not technically in a recession. And listen to this. Concerning the Washington Mutual collapse, Eric from New York writes us, "Believe it or not, I'm thrilled by the failure of WAMU. In 2004, they bounced a six-figure bank check issued to me from a real estate deal, refused to help me, and I lost the money and interest for 30 days. Who knew a bank check can bounce? They showed no concern. I had no recourse to their outrageous behavior." Well, you showed them, Eric. Tell us your stories at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
John, today in Pakistan, authorities say a bomb blast derailed a train, killing three people and injuring at least 15. The attack comes just days after a powerful bomb destroyed the Marriott Hotel in the nation's capital, Islamabad. Meanwhile, Washington is pressing Pakistani officials for answers after the U.S. suspended consular services, citing deepening security worries, not to mention another apparent clash between Pakistani and U.S. troops at the Pakistan-Afghanistan border. For more, we're joined by BBC correspondent Damian Grammaticus, who is reporting from Islamabad. Welcome, Damian. What do we know about this dispute along the Afghanistan-Pakistan border?
Well, we have two pretty clear descriptions of what went on, and neither of them quite tally. Basically, the Pentagon and NATO in Afghanistan say that two of their helicopters were flying in Afghan territory close to the border and were fired on by Pakistani troops. The Pakistanis have said those helicopters clearly crossed over the border into Pakistan and were then fired upon, and there was then also an exchange of ground fire between ground forces on both sides. So in effect, each one of them pointing the blame at the other side, and the only thing they both agree on is that this exchange took place. And that's a pretty poor sign, because remember, these are meant to be the two key allies, if you like, in the fighting the war on terror in this part of the world, and they're shooting at each other, not at the militants.
No, it certainly doesn't bode well for that relationship, and it's also not the first skirmish between the two.
No, it's not. There've been several skirmishes in which both, I think one US soldier has died in the past in skirmishes, and also Pakistani soldiers have. But I think this is coming at a time when there is a very clear raising of tension. The Pakistanis very clearly have been saying they do not want American aircraft, drones, missiles firing on or operating over Pakistani airspace, because they view that as a violation of their sovereignty. From the American side, I think the view we've been hearing is that if actionable intelligence, as it's called, is passed to Pakistan, well, then nothing much happens, and so the patience is wearing out, and American forces are keen to do the job themselves if Pakistan isn't going to.
Because we're really talking about a specific area, a targeted area, which would be the Northwest provinces, where the Taliban, from many reports we've been hearing in the past weeks and months, has essentially reconstituted there.
Yes, exactly. Although it's worth saying this is a pretty huge area. It's a stretch of border that's several hundred kilometers long. I've actually been right to the border where yesterday's incident took place, a place called
Damien,
Ghulam Khan.
Damien, did you take your pet bird with you when you went to the border?
It follows me wherever I go.
Anyway, what did you see at the border?
I was there with American troops last year in Ghulam Khan, what we saw then were Afghan police posts that had been rocketed by Taliban and Pakistani militants who'd come across the border, And it was a real concern. We were shown that area because it was a priority for the Americans to try and strengthen the border defences across there. And that is exactly where this exchange of fire has now taken place. So it's an area where there's tension and an area where there's real concern about infiltration and supply routes coming in from havens in Pakistan supporting the insurgency in Afghanistan.
Just to get back to the consular, to the U.S. Embassy in Islamabad, how would you describe operations at this point, given the attack of the Marriott Hotel last week?
Well, as I understand it, both the British and American embassies, consular services here, have been suspended. Now, that is a security thing, in as my understanding goes, that what that means basically is that there are offices in the city here that provide visa services. The trouble is that those offices are very popular. A lot of people wanting to travel collect at those offices to apply for visas. There are big crowds outside. There's one usually just a couple of hundred yards actually from where I'm talking to you now, where the British consular services are. And the fear is that that's a prime target now, that it's a Western-linked site. There's crowds of people there, and that it would be a place where militants may well wish to strike. So until security can be reviewed, those have been closed.
And President Zardari here at the UN General Assembly certainly spoke to this issue of the country's sovereign, about his position regarding U.S. troops along the Afghanistan border. He seemed very, very clear.
Yes, I mean, he, from his point of view, he says this is an issue about about Pakistani sovereignty, that violating Pakistani sovereignty simply undermines his own position, his own authority, because he's trying to rally Pakistanis to fight the militants. And what he says happens, and I think he has, there's quite a lot of truth in this, to be honest, is that when American and NATO forces cross over and start targeting the militants, well, Pakistanis who have little sympathy with the militants rally together and see this as an attack on Pakistan, and so their primary sort of dispute then is going to be with the attackers, with the aggressors who they see coming from outside, and it makes it much harder for him to win public support in the campaign against the militants if these people can then paint themselves in some way as defenders of Pakistan against American aggression. So that's why he's asking America not to intervene and not to carry out strikes. But the American side, mm-hmm. You know, the view from America is that if the job isn't being done properly, then somebody does have to target the militants.
Damian Grammaticus, thank you. Damian Grammaticus is a BBC reporter in Islamabad. And now we're going to head over to Richard Hake, who's got some headlines for us.
What happened, Richard?
Well, the guy made it. The Swiss nice. Adventurer, using a jet-propelled wing, flew across the English Channel from France in less than 10 minutes.
That's fantastic.
This guy, Yves Rossi, he leapt from a plane at an altitude of more than 8,800 feet, fired up the jets, and made it across to the White Cliffs of Dover.
And that's more important than the GDP?
Well, the economy grew at 2.8% this past spring. That's slower than previously estimated. The figures were just released just a little while ago. Other top stories this morning, J.P. Morgan Chase bought Washington Mutual last night for nearly $2 billion. Washington Mutual is the largest bank to fail in U.S. history.
Oh, there'll be another tomorrow.
Thank you, Richard. Oh, please, Don, don't say that. Thank you, Richard.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Good morning, I'm Adora Udoji. This is The Takeaway.
And I'm John Hockenberry. You could call it the golden age of television.
Good evening. The television and radio stations of the United States and their affiliated stations are proud to provide facilities for a discussion of issues in the current political campaign by the two major candidates for the presidency.
Sounds so formal, Howard K. Smith, then. Tonight is the first presidential debate between Republican John McCain and Democrat Barack Obama. Hey, they might even show up down there in Oxford, Mississippi. But back then, 1960, on this very day, the candidates were more reliable.
The candidates need no introduction. The Republican candidate, Vice President Richard M. Nixon, and the Democratic candidate, Senator John F. Kennedy.
It was the first ever presidential televised debate between Richard Nixon and John F. Kennedy, kind of a sideshow. People thought of it as something of a novelty. No one believed television would be decisive. But the sideshow quickly became the main event. I'm sure you've heard the story. Richard Nixon famously avoided using makeup, which made him look tired and worn out. Visually, the debate was a decisive win for the confident-looking young, handsome senator from Massachusetts, John Kennedy. But to listen to it, the callow, naive-sounding rich kid seems to be struggling to deal with a question about...
Senator, the vice president in his campaign has said that you are naive and at times immature. He has raised the question of leadership. On this issue, why do you think people should vote for you rather than the vice president?
Sound familiar?
There is no certain road to the presidency. There are no guarantees that if you take one road or another that you will be a successful president.
I can only say that my experience is there for the people to consider. Senator Kennedy's is there for the people to consider. I would say that the people now have the opportunity to evaluate his as against mine, and I think both he and I are going to abide by whatever the people decide.
Wow, back then, you may recall, Nixon was a pre-Watergate cold warrior who jousted with Soviet leaders for all the world to see. There were a few blemishes, of course. The famous Checkers speech didn't come up here. The debate was mostly about domestic issues. It's the economy. I guess they wouldn't have said stupid back then.
I'm not satisfied when the United States had last year the lowest rate of economic growth of any major industrialized society in the world, because economic growth means strength and vitality. It means we're able to sustain our defenses. It means we're able to meet our commitments abroad.
Listen, the youthful voice of JFK and the explainer voice of the sitting vice president.
Let's put it in terms that all of us can understand. We often hear gross national product discussed.
And like today, the economic discussion was a numbers game.
And in that respect, may I say that when we compare the growth in this administration with that of the previous administration, that then there was a total growth of 11% over 7 years. In this administration, there's been a total growth of 19% over 7 years. That shows that there's been more growth in this administration than in its predecessor.
There were many issues addressed in this debate, from the economy to farm subsidies to communism. But as you can hear, it eventually boiled down to a question of legacy. Where had America been since World War II? And who had the vision for the future leading to the 21st century?
Therefore, I think the question before the American people is, are we doing as much as we can do? Are we as strong as we should be? Are we as strong as we must be if we're going to maintain our independence?
It wasn't those presidents that changed the landscape as much as television. From that moment on, television introduced a new way Americans would make their choice at the voting booth, remembering television images that they'd seen during the campaign. You can hear the issues being drawn out, and in the sort of YouTube era that we live in, you can watch and listen to the debate and watch it again. TiVo, your future tonight.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
On this Friday, September 26th, it's time for the latest headlines. Richard Hake is in for Femi Okeh. Hey there, Richard.
Hi there, Adora. It's about 12 minutes before the hour. There might be a silver lining to Washington Mutual's spectacular collapse. The sale of its assets to JPMorgan Chase for $1.9 billion prevents the thrift's failure from depleting the FDIC's insurance fund. Talks over the Bush administration's $700 billion financial rescue plan are set to resume today, but it's unclear how many House Republicans will participate. White House talks fell apart yesterday amidst political squabbling over the plan. The economy's spring rebound turned out to be slightly less energetic than the government previously thought, and the road ahead is likely to be rocky as the country gets pounded by the worst financial crisis in decades. The Commerce Department reported today that the gross domestic product, or GDP, increased at a 2.8% annual rate in the April-June period. That wasn't as strong as the 3.3% growth made a month ago. China's tainted milk scandal continues to spread in Asia. In response, the European Union is joining other countries in banning imports of baby food containing Chinese milk. And finally, Letterman is not laughing. Remember 2 nights ago when John McCain canceled his appearance on The Late Show? Well, apparently David Letterman got even more upset when he found out that McCain went on CBS with Katie Couric.
I feel like an ugly date.
He dropped you.
I feel used.
Yeah.
I feel cheap. Mm. I feel sullied. I feel cratered.
I would thought you were going to...
Now, a McCain spokesperson says that the campaign believed on Wednesday that that wasn't a night for comedy, and they deeply regret offending Mr. Letterman.
Brokenhearted. David Letterman. Thank you, Richard.
Thank you very much, Richard. Tonight, John, presidential hopefuls and John McCain and Barack Obama are supposed to kick off the first debate of the general election. You think it's going to happen?
I don't know. It'd be interesting to see.
With all the wrangling in Congress over the Bush administration's proposed Wall Street bailout, it may not happen because McCain has vowed not to show up until a deal is done. And if he doesn't show, it would be the first time a scheduled presidential debate would not take place. For more on the history of this all, Alan Schroeder, he's the author of The Presidential Debates, 50 Years of High-Risk TV, joins us now. Good morning, Alan.
Good morning.
So what do you make of all this?
Well, you know, it's really hard to know what to make of it because history offers us no roadmap to kind of decode all of this. I think it's a very risky strategy for John McCain to tamper with the debates because I think that his campaign has forgotten one thing, and that is that the American people have a very proprietary feeling about the presidential debates, and they like them. It's, after the Super Bowl, the highest-rated program of the year, and a lot of people feel that this is a very important moment in the campaign. So I think he tampers with this at his peril.
Given what you know, how likely do you think it is to happen tonight?
I don't have any particular inside information. The one contact inside one of the campaigns that I talked to yesterday said it's as much a mystery to them as it is to the rest of the world. So I don't know. It seems to me that probably what they're trying to do is get him there. My belief is that he'll be there because I think politically it's too risky for him not to. But in order for that to happen, they have to give him some cover story here, some fig leaf that allows him to go in without looking like he's capitulated.
Alan, in the history of presidential debates, and we sort of dipped into the 1960 famous Nixon-Kennedy debate a few minutes ago, has there ever been a consensus on the format? In other words, as we move through time, is it sort of pretty clear the way a debate is conducted in a U.S. presidential campaign?
No, not at all. In fact, we've seen a lot of innovation and change over the years. And this year, the 08 election is the first time that the candidates, for instance, will ever be allowed to directly engage with each other. Up to this point, the campaigns have always been very protective of the candidates, and they've always gone to great lengths to make sure that they don't talk to each other. Well, the format tonight calls for a question to be asked, a response of 2 minutes by each candidate, and then 5 minutes of open discussion. That's something we've never seen in presidential debates. Back in 60, the clips that you were playing there, those were always joint press conferences, basically a panel of reporters asking questions. And we've seen the innovations of the town hall debate. We've seen debates in which the debaters are seated around a table with the moderator as opposed to standing up at a podium. And so there have been some changes. It's very slow. It's very incremental.
But as we've evolved over the last few campaigns, it appears that Jim Lehrer of PBS has become the Ryan Seacrest of presidential debates.
He's the guy. I'm sure he'd appreciate that description of himself.
Okay, you've watched all of the debates this year, and there certainly have been many, I think somewhere north of 20. What has struck you about John McCain and Barack Obama's individual styles as debaters?
Well, you know, I think that they're kind of an interesting match because it seems to me that the weaknesses of one are the strengths of the other and vice versa. So that you've got Barack Obama, who's this very introspective guy. I mean, when they ask him the question, you can literally see on his face that he's thinking through his response, which sometimes becomes sort of halting and a little roundabout in terms of getting to the point. Whereas John McCain is this kind of, you know, blunt, direct, almost staccato action verbs, you know, subject and predicate kind of speaker that presents a real interesting stylistic contrast here.
Well, you know, it's interesting going back to the Kennedy-Nixon debates. I mean, the visual look of Kennedy answering quickly and Nixon, the scholar vice president, thinking. Voters don't like to see their presidential candidates thinking.
Yeah, what does that say about us as a society? That's I don't know. I don't know if that's such a great thing.
Alan, you actually started off the conversation when you said that the presidential debates are just behind football, the Super Bowl.
Right.
So what does that say? Interesting question. But
well, yeah, exactly. That the game is a little more exciting. I mean, sometimes it is, sometimes it isn't. But, you know, that's what's so interesting. I was thinking about this in terms of this McCain strategy is what if 2 days before the Super Bowl, one of the teams just said, you know what, I'm not so sure I'm going to show up and play after all. You know, imagine the furor, imagine the outcry that would ensue.
And so what should we be looking for if this debate actually does take place?
Well, I think one of the interesting things is how do they integrate the economy into a discussion that is supposedly devoted to foreign policy and national security. Now, the irony here is that it's the two campaigns themselves that switched the order of debate topics. Originally, this was supposed to be about a debate about the economy, and at the campaign's insistence, the order of those topics from the first and the third debate were swapped. However, I would expect that Jim Lehrer, the moderator, and the candidates themselves, they all want to talk about the economy. So I think if it's under the rubric of national security or the global economy or what have you, I have a feeling that that's where a lot of the conversation will center tonight.
And I guess if you count the debates as, you know, his rating, the fact that Jim Lehrer actually outrates Ryan Seacrest is a sign of a health in American democracy.
You better believe it. And the thing about these debates is they are television shows. There's no question about it. And they're very akin to other kinds of TV shows like reality shows. But there's a huge difference is that they have, you know, a historical consequence. Nixon and Kennedy 48 years ago tonight made that case once and for all.
And, of course, the Lincoln-Douglas debates, they were a traveling roadshow, and those took, like, hours to complete.
Hours,
correct?
3 hours. They would stand up. One would speak for an hour. The other one would rebut for, you know, a lengthy period of time.
But standing room only.
It was the best show in town wherever they went.
Alan, very quickly, if you could ask a question tonight, what would it be?
You've really put me on the spot.
Imagine you're Ryan Seacrest
now. I stumped you there.
You totally stumped me. You know, I'm so like focused on my little narrow research into presidential debates that anytime I meet one of these people, all I want to ask them about is their, you know, debate prep or something insane like that. But if I could get, after this is all over, maybe not so much on the stage, if I could get John McCain aside, I'd sure want to know what was going through his head when he made this decision to potentially boycott the debate in Oxford, Mississippi.
Alan Schroeder, thanks for joining us this morning.
My pleasure.
Alan Schroeder is the author of The Presidential Debates, 50 Years of High-Risk TV, and he's also an assistant professor of journalism at Northeastern University.
We're always on at The Takeaway. Election Day is less than 6 weeks away. Tonight, you can join us online. I'll be live Twittering the first presidential debate, if it happens, at 9 Eastern Time, McCain versus Obama. That's tonight.
And Don writes us in an email, John McCain's attempt to bail out of the debate tonight makes me think of his class ranking at Annapolis. It's typical of the D student to try to finagle a way out of an exam that he hasn't prepared for. The American electorate overlooked Bush's C average, maybe even identified with it, but 8 years of rule by the cut-ups in the back row is enough, isn't it?
You can join the debate at our website, thetakeaway.org, and on Twitter tonight. Here's today's takeaway.
It's really just a question of everybody being able to hold their hands, hold their nose, and jump.
It's New York Times reporter David Herzenhorn talking about the bailout plan at the $700 billion shenanigans on Capitol Hill today.
I'm Adora Udoji.
And I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
Still no deal on Capitol Hill. No ink on the paper. So I guess this is the end of the world. Right, Ghostbuster?
Human sacrifice, dogs and cats living together, mass hysteria.
Well, we got everything but the dogs and cats living together. We do have the largest bank failure in U.S. history, Washington Mutual, a bipartisan bailout in D.C. Call it Washington Mutually Exclusive. Want to buy a mortgage on America's future? What are the closing costs? Find out on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Friday, September 26th, and nothing like a little Ghostbusters first thing in the morning.
Right. Good morning, Adora.
Today, there are reports from Washington of shouting matches on Capitol Hill, a Treasury secretary down on his knee, and Republican lawmakers bailing on President Bush's proposed rescue plan for Wall Street. We'll have a report. Also, we'll take a look at the trial of Republican Senator Ted Stevens from Alaska. He's the first sitting member of Congress to face criminal charges in nearly 30 years. And some religious leaders this weekend plan to challenge the law against campaigning from the pulpit. Those stories are coming up, but first, these headlines.
It is the biggest bank failure in U.S. history. Federal regulators have taken over Washington Mutual's assets and sold them to J.P. Morgan Chase for $2 billion. Don't worry, the change doesn't mean much for regular customers. Still, there's no deal on the economic bailout plan, and things are tense on Capitol Hill. Dogs and cats living together, you know the drill. It looked like lawmakers had reached an agreement yesterday afternoon, but it all changed at the White House Economic Summit with John McCain and Barack Obama. Republicans there presented a new proposal. Congressman Barney Frank told CNN it came as a surprise.
This is a kind of an ambush plan that doesn't come out until yesterday afternoon. And I said, it's not a serious effort. We can't get Senator McCain to say whether he's for it or against it. The Republican Party is in such a complete shambles that it's hard to do anything serious.
Well, ambush or not, GOP lawmakers say instead of the government buying up bad debt, they want tax breaks and a new government-backed insurance program like the FDIC.
Tonight's first presidential debate is on hold. Barack Obama says he plans to show up at the University of Mississippi today, but John McCain would not comment, saying the massive financial bailout plan comes first. Alaska Senator Ted Stevens' corruption trial is underway. His attorney says Stevens just didn't realize the cost and scope of a pricey makeover of his cabin. Prosecutors say he just lied on Senate finance disclosure forms.
Pakistan's new president, Asif Ali Zardari, warned that not even allies will be permitted to cross his border.
Violating our nation's sovereignty is not helpful in eliminating the terrorist menace. Indeed, this could have the opposite effect.
The war on terror has become a spat between U.S. and Pakistan. Yesterday, Pakistani soldiers fired at U.S. helicopters they say crossed over from Afghanistan. The markets are ready, poised to open much, much lower this morning, according to the Dow futures. Oil prices fell a little below $107 a barrel. And we're talking about the largest bank failure in U.S. history and the continuing ripple effect of the financial catastrophe that Washington is attempting to deal with. What's your take on that?
Do you have an account with Washington Mutual? How are you feeling this morning with news that your bank has been taken over? We want to hear your story, 877-8-MY-TAKE, or drop us a note at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. Well, it was another late night in Washington. Democrats accusing Republicans of ambush. Republicans in open revolt against the president's $700 billion Wall Street bailout deal. Basically, the deal is there's no deal. We go now to Washington, where Todd Zwillick of Capital News Connection joins us. Todd, no deal, a lot of drama last night, and the campaigns are very much involved in what's going on with the financial bailout negotiations. Bring us up to date.
Yeah, and the people who've been doing the negotiating all of this time think that the campaigns being involved has made things a little bit harder, not necessarily easier, which stands to reason. I mean, presidential politics and Capitol Hill policymaking don't usually mix very well, and that's true in this case, too. So
let's lay out the matrix here. Basically, the Democrats are the leadership in Congress. It's in their interest to make a deal that makes Barack Obama look good. The Republicans have no interest in doing that. Meanwhile, the economy is in the balance. How does it shake out?
Well, that's part of the problem, is that now presidential politics is part of this. You know, when this thing started, Secretary Paulson and Ben Bernanke's mission was to take politics out of this if they could. They tried to rush it a bit, but their message was, this is a time for leaders to be leaders, that it's not really about the elections. It's unfortunate that all of this is happening right before the presidential election, but we can't help that. We need to pass a plan and get everybody on board and show some leadership. Even though voters are against this and constituents are against it, that's not the most important thing. The most important thing is to unfreeze credit, and that's what we have to do. I think that remains the case. The most important thing is to unfreeze credit, but now you've got the Obama factor and the McCain factor mixed up in it. The people who – and keep in mind, when you say Republicans are in open revolt, it's only House Republicans. Senate Republicans are on board and in on the negotiations with Treasury, with Democrats of the House and Senate. It's House Republicans that are doing this at the moment. Only they know their true motivations. They have some pretty legitimate policy concerns that they're pursuing. But now the fact that the McCain factor is involved and he's quote-unquote suspended his campaign and won't debate until it's solved adds a whole new dimension to this and forces everyone to question their motivations. Are they doing this for their legitimate policy concerns? Probably. Are they doing this to make John McCain look as good as possible so that he can appear to save the day at the last minute? Possibly. We don't know. But those questions are getting asked now as the deal sort of unravels because they've brought this into this.
In effect, though, success by the Democrats could equal failure politically, because if it's a party line vote and this thing passes, then it becomes the Democrat plan, not the Bush plan, and certainly not a bipartisan initiative to save the economy.
That's right. And Nancy Pelosi and Steny Hoyer, the Democratic leaders, and Harry Reid, the Senate leader, do not want that to happen. That's why they've gone to the lengths that they've gone to make this a bipartisan deal. They don't want to be left holding the political bag if things go wrong. There's no question about that. And Barney Frank made the point yesterday that more than politics, at least he says, that it has to be bipartisan, because if it's not, it won't bring stability to the markets. Unless something passes with broad majorities, the market's going to think, well, that could just change in a year. Because it passed by four votes, they're going to come back and change it because it doesn't have a big consensus around it. So that's probably part of the reason why they want Republicans to. Nancy Pelosi has said she wants 100 to 150. She wants a majority of Republicans, which would be about 100, behind this deal. And there's probably a little bit of both of that. They want market stability, but they also don't want to be responsible if it doesn't work. And no one knows if it's going to work.
Well, quickly, Todd, I mean, before we even really have a bill with a small group of players, we've already seen very passionate yelling and screaming. I mean, Chris Dodd yesterday looked like he was having an aneurysm when he came out of the Wall Street meeting or the White House meeting. What's this going to be like on the floor? Is there going to be debate? Is everybody in the Congress going to be able to stand up and throw bricks at this plan before it actually passes?
Well, usually with things like this, at least in the House, Democrats have a history lately of limiting debate and making it pretty short, maybe 2 hours, maybe 3 hours. I don't know. People are going to throw a lot of bricks at it, but they probably won't have a whole heck of a lot of time. And whatever does reach the floor probably will have an agreement. People will definitely want to throw some bricks at it. The question is, in the Senate, will anybody use their power to slow this down? They won't be able to stop it. It has enough votes. Will they slow it down by 2 or 3 days by filibustering a motion? But that, again, that won't stop it. That might slow it down.
And it could be a $1 billion delay if the markets wait for this. We already are looking at a very, very slow, terrifying open on Wall Street this morning. Todd Zwillick, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, sure.
And joining us now is Dan Gross, senior editor at Newsweek. He sees the numbers. The GDP numbers are out. The Wall Street numbers look like they're going to be pretty depressing. The $700 billion number, that's a famous number right by now. Dan Gross, how bad is the economy looking as this debate goes on? And what effects are we likely to see as things move forward here?
Well, I don't want to give too much away, but my plan for an article next week, you know, was, you know, presuming a big bailout deal would be finished Thursday, Friday, we'd be processing it. And next week I'd be writing about, okay, now back to the real economy, and now we can all focus on how, you know, things are deteriorating there. You know, there have been great sort of enthusiasm about the prospects for a bailout, but some of the numbers we've seen this week, unemployment claims, industrial production, some of the earnings reports from big companies are showing that things, you know, on Main Street aren't going so hot. And a week from today, next Friday, we will get the jobs report for September, you know, which shows the unemployment rate and how many jobs were lost. And I'm expecting that's not going to be a very positive one, given everything we're seeing. So I think there's a degree to which all this focus on the bailout and the banks and all this stuff has caused us collectively to take our eye off the underlying economy, and the news there ain't so hot.
Well, let's look at Main Street. I mean, a lot of corners of Main Street around the world are Washington Mutual ATMs, and now that bank has gone under. I mean, certainly Main Street is aware of Washington Mutual. What are the implications of this, you know, largest bank failure in U.S. history for this frozen credit market problem that's having so many difficulties for small businesses?
Well, here's the irony. The implications of WaMu's failure are likely to be de minimis compared with what's going on in Washington. And, you know, we see two systems at work. The system for processing bank failures, which has been around for 75 years, you know, the FDIC gets involved and they have insurance and all that. That's evolved, and they are professionals. This is what they do. They've managed 12 bank failures so far. There are still some grown-up bankers out there. Many of them work at J.P. Morgan Chase, which has weathered this storm really well. And so basically, you know, WaMu did not have to declare Chapter 11. It didn't have to tap into the deposit insurance fund. You know, they had $188 billion in deposits. The fear was that could swamp the FDIC's fund. The FDIC just basically arranged for J.P. Morgan to acquire its branches, its deposits, its customers, its mortgages, no cost to the taxpayer, no cost to the insurance fund. You know, the shareholders, you know, whose stock, they'd already seen the stock go down to two, they're going to be wiped out. Some of the bondholders are going to. But, you know, this is the biggest bank failure ever. Most people will experience this as something of a blip. We're going to see bank branches close, but there's going to be no runs. People are not going to have to worry about their money. The professionals are in charge there.
Well, I should point out the president is expected to speak in the next 20 minutes. We're going to carry that live. So clearly the difficulties in Washington are continuing this crisis here. Quickly on WaMu, and it is WaMu, not WAMU.
You say potato.
There we go. Beautiful, beautiful. So, yeah, but we won't be saying at all. We're going to be saying J.P. Morgan from now on.
It's a little-known Cole Porter song, actually.
There we go.
Never made it big.
But what do you think the message is on this seizure? Is it to global markets saying, hey, the dollar's okay, the treasury's okay, we're not on the hook for another $188 billion? Or is it the bank was going to seize up and depositors were going to be in trouble, and it's really a message for the U.S. economy?
I actually think it's, you know, this could be seen coming a mile away.
Really?
This was a, you know, in contrast to like Lehman Brothers or Bear Stearns, which, you know, collapsed overnight and over the weekend, people had been talking about Washington Mutual going down, having to find a buyer, not being able to make it for months and months. That's why its stock had been pushed down, you know, to $2 a share. So this has not come as a surprise, and I think the fact that, you know, it didn't have to go into Chapter 11. You didn't get that messiness that this deal was arranged and J.P. Morgan Chase stepping up, showing it has the capacity to do it.
Well, who knows? Maybe it's Paulson just saying, you know, we can't do anything on Capitol Hill. At least we can take care of this mess, so let's get it off the table.
Right. So yeah. It's, you know, this is the WaMu situation, I think, shows a system that is working and intact. It's obviously bad that the company failed, but
the system,
you know, the immediate impact, it's not going to,
right.
It shouldn't cause sort
the
of
backstop work.
Customers.
The backstop work. Well, we'll see what the president says about there. Dan Gross, we got to go, but thanks so much for joining us.
Anytime, John.
Dan Gross, senior editor at Newsweek. It's WaMu. WaMu, folks.
Yeah.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion, discussions, and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
This morning we're talking about that $700 billion bailout plan for Washington that's being debated on Capitol Hill, and the collapse of Washington Mutual, the largest bank failure in U.S. history. Sarah writes us an email saying, check out WaMu's website. WaMu customers, welcome to J.P. Morgan Chase. They didn't miss a beat, she says. Tell us what you think, 877-8-MYTAKE, or drop us a note at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
Missing a beat? Well, he could be missing a debate tonight. John McCain still hasn't committed to showing up in Mississippi for the first presidential debate with Barack Obama. Speaking of presidential speeches, the president is expected to speak within the next 10 minutes about the financial crisis and the failure of Congress to reach a deal on the bailout plan. Certainly, we're all going to be watching that. We'll be carrying the speech live, by the way. But around the nation, people are watching what's going on in Washington, even though their concern for issues may be different from county to county. Counties that count, we've been focusing on that over the course of the campaign. And Andrea Bernstein, our political director, was visiting Prince William County in Northern Virginia this week. She's taking the pulse of places like Prince William County that seem to be in transition, moving in this case from pro-Republican to pro-Democrat. Andrea is with us in the studio. Let's start with the debate and what might be decisive for people in battleground states. Andrea, what do you think people might be listening for tonight?
Well, one of the things in Prince William County is that immigration was a huge local issue there. And we haven't heard a lot about immigration so far in the general election. A lot of people are looking to hear from it tonight. In Prince William County, there was a dispute over day laborers, as there frequently is. There was an effort to get them a center to wait instead of loitering in front of the 7-Elevens. The people and the town officials who tried to do that were thrown out. And subsequently, a law was passed that everybody in Prince William County who was stopped for any offense, for any reason, would have their citizenship papers taken, checked, and then most of the immigrants left literally overnight, it was explained to me, including some of them abandoning very nice houses. But this is an issue that is really top of the mind. It's raw. Yesterday morning, I was in the Yorkshire restaurant in Manassas, a little bit lower down on the economic scale, but people still working people, going around talking to people, eating their French toast and Western omelets. This couple, Scott McCarter and his breakfast companion, were talking about their feelings about John McCain, which are a little bit counterintuitive.
I like the borders to be really taken care of quicker and better than this game plan that's just hasn't been followed through with. Got a comment, Scott?
They tried amnesty, another amnesty.
Uh-huh. You didn't like what he was doing?
No. Most of the Americans did not either. So they made their voices heard.
Uh-huh. Do you hold that against Senator McCain?
Oh, yes, certainly.
You think that it might affect your vote?
It would have, except from voting for Palin. I'm not voting for McCain.
Wow, that's the first time I've heard that. Very, very interesting. And the decisive issue is immigration for him.
It is immigration. And,
but it is hard to catch that logic because ultimately a vote for Palin is a vote for John McCain.
Correct. But this is sort of the Republican Party that didn't like John McCain. Remember, they called him Juan McCain in the primaries because they thought he was too pro-immigrant. There is this sort of grasping for detail. So you would think in a county like Prince William County, traditionally Republican, voted for Bush in 2000, that the immigration issue would be ginning up the Republican vote. But guess what? There are a lot of Latinos who live there who are voters who are also very now inspired to go to the polls. One of them was Leo Vega. He ran a bodega right next to the Yorkshire restaurant. And I asked him what happened to his business when everybody left.
How about your own business? Has it been affected?
Oh, my God. Compared to last year, we've gone down 75%. And I was looking at the news, these multi millionaire companies, they're asking for help. Imagine us, you know. I don't want $700 million or billion dollars, you know. I would love to have at least, you know, some type of money to keep my business afloat. And this is mine and my wife's. We started this.
Well, you can really feel the pain there. These are passionate supporters of Barack Obama, or is it more lukewarm, like those McCain supporters?
No, they're without a doubt. I mean, there were people that, quite a few people with accents across the income scale who were naturalized citizens. Some people were business owners. Some people came and worked with the mall. They were all for Obama, and they all told me with great certainty that they were going out to vote. So, of course, these people have made up their minds. The people in the middle, like a woman, Tina, who worked as an events planner, who I spoke to, she said she's a Republican. She's voted Republican all her life, but she is struggling. And she said she was really considering thinking about voting for Obama. When I talked to her about immigration, she had a very complex view. On the one hand, she said it's not up to us Americans to solve everybody's problems. But on the other hand,
I just had some work done on my house. The Americans that I had come in and do the job didn't do a good job. The second company that came in, one laid tile, one group laid tile, one group laid carpet. Neither one of them spoke barely any English, but they did an excellent job.
So the levels are complex, and one of the reasons that people do want a debate is because people all over Prince William County were yearning for policy details. When I said, what do you want to hear at the debate, if it happens, people said, I want to know more, what I want to do. I don't want to just hear these negative ads. Here's Tina.
There are some things that I need to hear from him that I'm not hearing yet. I'm still seeing ads that just tell me I watched both the Republican convention and the Democratic convention. I was unimpressed by McCain's speech. He looked phony. He sounded phony. He sounded like he didn't know. I just was not impressed.
Boy, not a lot of enthusiasm there. You can hear the county in transition. And all over this immigration issue, I should say, you mentioned that this was over loitering of immigrants. They would say, in fact, they were being picked up for day labor at the 7-Eleven, right, at the beginning.
Right.
That's what they were. I just wanted to make
that
clear. That's
right. And these undecideds, they want the debate tonight. Even if they think McCain should be working on the bailout, they want to hear more from him.
Andrea Bernstein, thanks for joining us. More on the counties that count as the campaign continues. Richard Hake now joins us for headlines.
And John, it is now 28 minutes past the hour. We're waiting to hear from President Bush, who's expected to make a statement from the South Lawn of the White House in just a couple of minutes. He's expected to make that statement concerning the congressional negotiations on the $700 billion rescue plan for the U.S. financial markets. The president's statement follows late-night talks on Capitol Hill that pitted Democrats against Republicans, who apparently are not going along with the president's proposal. Well, so long, Washington Mutual. J.P. Morgan Chase bought the bank last night for nearly $2 billion. The 119-year-old bank is the largest casualty in the string of bank failures.
I wanted to buy that bank. I was sleeping.
Well, you can use your $700 billion.
Yeah,
I own AIG. Come on.
You've been trying to get $700 billion from people all week. I heard you.
All right. Bush coming up. Thank you, Richard.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, soliciting opinions about schools that offer cash rewards to students for improved grades and attendance records. Is it ethical? Is it like merit bonuses in business? Viewpoints at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. At 28 minutes before the hour, the markets are open and they are tanking, at least in the early going. The S&P is down well over 1%. The Dow Jones Industrial Average down 130. You know, this morning, talking about the Washington Mutual story, when we said, tell us your bank story, I thought to myself, oh, yeah, that'll work. But get this, Marissa on our website. I had various accounts with Washington Mutual for 10 years. Last year, we applied for another mortgage with them. It was for a second home. It was going to be a bit of a stretch. But I was shocked when at one point the loan officer guided us to lie and claim we had a renter, which we could write up a lease for, present as income, and that would bring us up to the income level we would need to qualify. I was dumbfounded. Am I shocked to hear this morning's news, Marissa writes? No. That's an amazing story. And Washington Mutual was acquired by J.P. Morgan Chase. And we are waiting President Bush's statement from the White House live, which will address this crisis. Andrea Bernstein is with us here in the studio. And Todd Zwillick from Capital News Connection is also live with us from Capitol Hill. Andrea, I have to figure there aren't too many more iterations of this dialogue where the president talks to the nation, Congress attempts to get a bailout deal, and then nothing happens, and then the president speaks again. Not too many more iterations before the entire world is going to think that it's a loony bin around here.
Yeah, I'd say not. And I'd say that what seems to be happening is I don't remember seeing a lot of those House Republicans at the Republican National Convention. These people have their own elections coming up in 5 weeks, and they don't necessarily see their interests as aligned with either President Bush's or Senator McCain's, and that's part of what's going on here.
Todd Zwillick, is it every man and woman for him or herself down there in D.C.?
Well, it always is this soon before an election, but especially so when you have a lame duck president who's on his way out, and more especially so when his approval ratings are hovering in the 20s. It very much is. Not only is it every man and woman for his or herself, but a lot of these House Republicans have a lot motivating them to untether themselves from the president. It doesn't necessarily hurt at all, at least not in some districts. Every district's a little different. But in a lot of districts, it doesn't hurt to distance yourself from this White House, from Bush and Cheney, in any way that you can. One would hope that people aren't playing too naked a politics if things are as precarious as the president and Henry Paulson say they are. We don't know their true motivations, it's true they do have political motivations, it's not a bad idea to do it now.
But what's interesting here is that Representative Barney Frank actually made the statement that the Republicans are so confused right now, it's hard to know who to deal with specifically. And it may be more than just political rhetoric. I mean, there might be actual truth to that at this point.
Well, he seemed genuinely confused yesterday, especially after all of these talks, and then the House GOP plan kind of got popped on everyone. And we talked about it sort of earlier this morning, but another thing that was very confusing about it to Frank and to other Republicans who were in the room with him was that the Republican who was sent as the representative of the House Republicans in those negotiations wasn't authorized to negotiate.
Well, the question really,
why is he here?
I mean, and that's the question for the president. I mean, why is he here? What can he possibly say? We're awaiting a statement from the White House, live from the White House, from President Bush. What can he possibly say that's going to bring those Republicans around, Andrea?
Well, it's hard to know because he doesn't necessarily control them. I mean, even the Republican base, a lot of them, doesn't like President Bush at this point. So what exactly he can do to sort of enforce party discipline, we're going to find out. I mean, I think one of the problems for McCain is, in some ways, the sort of contradiction of his campaign is really apparent here. He's running as the non-Republican, as the guy who doesn't agree with his party. But now he's asking his party to come to his rescue. That is a very, very tough and precarious position to be in.
We should note the Dow Jones Industrial Average is now down around 130 points, and the S&P 500, which is probably the more accurate gauge of what's going on generally in the stock market, that's down close to 2% at this point. It'll be interesting during this statement of the president, for no matter how long it is, every one of the networks is going to have the little bug there down in the corner that will show the market number. And, you know, if it just sort of plummets while he's talking, I mean, what kind of a message is that for the campaign, Andrea?
I think it's a very, very tough message. And, you know, my inbox has already filled up this morning with detailed statements, memos, and arguments from both the McCain and Obama campaign, and the both of them talking about how the other one is at fault for what happened. So, I mean, the serious finger-pointing is really going on. And nor does this in any way feel, except in name only, like a suspended campaign from the McCain. I mean, perhaps they're not running ads, but I'm still getting a lot of information about why they're the guy, not Obama.
Todd Zwillick, how's your inbox? And have you talked with anybody who thinks that the president can calm these waters?
Well, on the latter question, people, you know, a lot of Republicans were encouraged after the president's speech the other night that he had finally sounded the notes that they wanted to hear, telling Main Street, as it were, small towns, people who don't think that they have any real tangible connection to Wall Street fat cats, as they call them, that this, if there's a banking meltdown and an economic meltdown, that it affects them directly. Most of them thought that the president had effectively made that case, which, frankly, they said they needed if they were going to support something unpopular. They needed the president to be out in front telling people why they needed to support it, even if voters don't like it. Now, the question is,
go ahead.
Well, the question is, he made that case. The question is, did anybody listen? And that's the question with this president at this point. Any president who's a lame duck and is on their way out does not have as much influence. But not every president has a credibility problem because of things like the Iraq War. Right. These things are all connected.
And we're getting some of that.
Some people tune out.
Let me just jump in there, Todd. We want to remind our stations we're going to omit headlines over the next few minutes because we are waiting. President Bush will be speaking live at the White House, commenting on the bailout negotiations, possibly the largest bank failure in U.S. history, which happened overnight at Washington Mutual, and you know, whatever else he can do to calm these waters. Adora?
Todd, I was going to ask, given this lack of credibility that you just mentioned and his lame duck status, what do you make of this timing of going before the cameras 2 hours before congressional leaders were to sit down again to try to hammer out a deal?
I think at this stage it probably can't hurt. It probably can't hurt because they're all on pretty much the same page. Keep in mind that they're viewing this as sort of a five-pointed star or a five-spoked wheel. I don't know if that makes any sense, but you have
Todd, hold on there. The president has just arrived.
Oh, he's coming out. Okay.
Now. Yes.
We need a rescue plan. This is it's hard work. Our proposal is a big proposal, and the reason it's big. It's hard work. Our proposal is a big proposal. And the reason it's big and substantial is because we got a big problem. We also need to move quickly. Now, anytime you have a plan this big that is moving this quickly, that requires legislative approval, it creates challenges. Members want to be heard. They want to be able to express their opinions, and they should be allowed to express their opinions. There are disagreements over aspects of the rescue plan.
We'll be right back after this short break. President speaking live.
The Takeaway is made possible by...
Can you guys plug the president through so I can hear him?
Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com. You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
We were just listening before we had to break away there and actually interrupted the president speaking live from the White House. We're going to have those remarks, which we can play a little bit later. But basically, the president was talking off the cuff, urging lawmakers to actually make a deal and get the bailout plan passed. An interesting moment of timing, 5 minutes after the markets open, not very positively. But is there any sense, Todd Zwillick, who's on the line with us from Washington, from Capital News Connection, any sense, Todd, that the president's urging is going to have any impact?
Well, like we were saying just briefly before, it probably can't hurt. at this point. This is a five-way discussion between House and Senate Democrats and House and Senate Republicans. That's four. And then the administration is five. You've got four of the five on board pretty much. Keep in mind that the president and the Democrats in Congress, now that the Paulson plan is essentially dead and they've added all these other things on, that they had this so-called tentative agreement yesterday, that was the White House and congressional Democrats on board together. And Senate Republicans, for that matter, most of them anyway, the ones that are important.
That was a really interesting – he spoke for maybe 2 or 3 minutes. It was not long.
Not long. A little bit of a pep talk, a little bit of an encouragement. I don't know if that was reassurance for the market or for the public or a little jolt in the rear ends of Congress to get something done. But look, as far as Congress is concerned, believe me, they know how the White House feels about this. They've talked to the president. They've talked to Paulson repeatedly. Nothing he said there was any surprise to them. So that's a bully pulpit moment. Does it do anything to light a fire under them vis-a-vis the market or the public? That's the question.
Well, they're not lighting any fires down in Washington. It's pouring rain down there. But for listeners who heard us break away from the speech, the president was speaking down in Washington. We had to break away for a time post that we didn't have any control over. But in any case, the president claims that everyone is agreed that action is needed now on this plan. Do you think everyone does agree that action is needed now, Andrea?
I think that it is a very uncomfortable move for the Republican Party to socialize the government. And I think when you look at $700 billion, I mean, the other night I was writing it down with my kids at the dinner table. How many zeros is it, we asked? It's 11 zeros. It takes a long time to write it. It's everybody's tax cut plans. It's everybody's health care plans. It's sort of the next 20 years of government that is looking at being signed away right now. And people, I think, realize the implication of that. It's not an easy thing to do, nor is the public happy about it. I mean, even the people who are most happy about it are happy about it only because they feel like it's going to staunch the flow.
Well, Bush didn't sound happy when he was speaking. Here's a portion of his remarks made just moments ago.
Members want to be heard. They want to be able to express their opinions, and they should be allowed to express their opinions. There are disagreements over aspects of the rescue plan, but there is no disagreement that something substantial must be done. The legislative process is sometimes not very pretty, but we are going to get a package passed.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway, yes, with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
We've interrupted the president twice now this morning, and we're not going to do it a third time. His remarks now in their entirety in just a moment. We are speaking of the president, who has spoken within the last few minutes from the White House, urging Congress to pass the $700 billion or whatever number it turns out to be bailout plan that they were not able to get passed or agreement on last night. The markets are open. They are off their lows of the morning so far, but still Dow Jones Industrial Average is down about 1% or more. The S&P 500 is down about 1% and change, and that seems to be the issue right now. With us is Andrea Bernstein, the Takeaway's political director, and also Todd Zwillick from Capital News Connection. But first, let's hear in their entirety President Bush's somewhat urgent remarks that he gave at the White House just moments ago.
It continues to work with the Congress on a rescue plan, and we need a rescue plan. This is it's hard work. Our proposal is a big proposal. And the reason it's big and substantial is because we got a big problem. We also need to move quickly. Now, anytime you have a plan this big, that is moving this quickly, that requires legislative approval, it creates challenges. Members want to be heard. They want to be able to express their opinions, and they should be allowed to express their opinions. There are disagreements over aspects of the rescue plan, but there is no disagreement that something substantial must be done. The legislative process is sometimes not very pretty, but we are going to get a package passed. We will rise to the occasion. Republicans and Democrats will come together and pass a substantial rescue plan.
That's the president speaking about 20 minutes ago live at the White House in a tone that sounds a little bit like kind of live radio can be, you know, where you're kind of winging it. You know, there is the impression, Todd Zwillick, down in Washington, that the entire U.S. government might be winging it at this moment. Is that the impression you got?
I don't know what you're talking about, the people winging it on live radio. I don't know why you say that.
I thought you were going to say, I don't know why you're talking about people winging it in government.
Well, clearly that's sort of what's going on now. But I just want to add something to a question you asked earlier, John, which was, is the president correct that everyone agrees that something must be done now? Because something interesting is going on Capitol Hill, or at least was yesterday. Nobody is saying this into a microphone, or at least nobody that I've heard is saying this into a microphone. But there is paper circulating throughout the House and certain quarters of the Senate being circulated by Republicans that the economy won't necessarily melt down if Congress does nothing, that it's not as urgent as some would have you believe. There's a letter circulating with 40 or so or 35 well-known, well-noted economists making the case that—
100, actually, because we spoke to one earlier this morning.
Oh, you did? Okay, so you know about this. So it's 100. I thought it was—yesterday it was in the 50s, so they added—they doubled their numbers. But anyway, that paper is circulating, which is being circulated to build a case that they don't have to do this instantly. That's why those papers circulate like
that. An alternative view out of the 535, which is in this committee of the financial bailout. We're going to come back and talk about this in a moment. But first, Richard Hake is here with some headlines of what else is going on in the world. Richard?
And John, stocks are sharply lower in early trading as efforts to finalize a $700 billion financial bailout deal has been unraveled now. The seizure of Washington Mutual by federal regulators is also serving as a sobering reminder of the widespread problems in the banking industry. Meanwhile, credit markets are tightening further as fears of a deepening economic crisis are driving investors to buy safe haven treasury bills. The Dow Jones Industrial Average is down some 126 points right now. China's tainted milk scandal continues to spread in Asia. In response, the European Union is joining other countries in banning imports of baby food containing Chinese milk. Tensions are rising in Pakistan after a bomb blast caused a train to derail in the eastern Punjab province, killing 4 people and wounding 15 others. Also off the coast of Somalia, pirates captured a Ukrainian ship carrying at least 30 military tanks. The equipment could be very dangerous in Somalia, already awash with weapons. The Chinese are attempting their first spacewalk. The astronauts blasted off yesterday morning and should return in a couple of days. And rather tropical storm Kyle is off the coast of Bermuda right now, is moving north-northwest at 13 miles per hour. Winds are at 60 miles per hour right now. And forecasters say it could reach hurricane strength winds by tomorrow.
A lot going on. And, of course, at the lead of all of it, the president speaking just moments ago, urging Congress to pass this bailout bill. Andrea Bernstein is with us, Takeaway's political director, also Todd Zwillick. Adora, so here we have a situation where the president has just spoken. There's clearly kind of an open revolt in the Republican Party, certainly on the House floor, against the president's plan. The Democrats are attempting to put something together. There is a debate tonight. Maybe it will take place with the two candidates. John McCain hasn't said he will go to the debate. What are Americans, Andrea, and you just returned from one of the counties that's in transition, what are Americans to make of what is going on at this moment?
Well, I mean, very few people understand it, and I think that's clear. I mean, even people who own businesses were sort of trying to figure this out, puzzle it through. I mean, one of the things that I found when the question was asked yesterday, was it right for Senator McCain to return to Washington to work on this, is that it tracked exactly who you were voting for. So if you said, if you were voting for Senator McCain, you thought, yes, it was a wonderful idea. If you were voting for Senator Obama, you thought it was a terrible idea, and if you were undecided, you didn't know.
But we heard today, talking to the Patchwork Nation folks at the Christian Science Monitor, that people who were in fear seemed to be making up their mind. In other words, that the economy is tracking towards Barack Obama, but in general, the undecideds are suddenly evaporating because fear makes people come to a decision.
I'm still kind of stuck on this President Bush speech moments ago, trying to figure out what the conversation was like among his advisors making the decision to come out and speak in front of the cameras. I mean, this is not a president that we see regularly in this manner. And you just have to wonder, why wasn't there some attempt to rally his Republican colleagues?
Well, this may be it.
Together.
I mean, this may be coming at 9:36 in the morning, as it did. This may be both a message to the stock markets, like, hang in there, we're still working, and to the House Republicans, we're going to turn up the heat. You know, I mean, he is still the president of the United States. They still have a lot of power, and these people want to get reelected. So there may be some messaging going on there, like, we're going to start tightening the screws.
Well, Todd Zwillich, we want to send you off to Capitol Hill to get the take the pulse of really what is the reaction to the president's speech. We want to give you the last word, though, here as you go off to figure out what the reaction is going to be and if there will be any progress on this bailout negotiation. Todd?
Well, we'll find out. We'll start to find out in just a couple of hours, at least heading into the weekend. The principals, as they're called, are heading back into meetings at 11:30, and the principals are only five people at this point. They've been winnowed down, and the 20 or so people who were meeting Thursday and Friday have all been kicked out of the room. So now a meeting of just five people, maybe their staffs, but maybe not, go in at 11:30, and we'll all be there hovering and staking them out. Will they come out of the meeting today with an agreement? I tend to doubt it, at least not in the middle of the day. I think this goes into the weekend, if you believe that they're as far apart as they say they are. And those House Republicans are dug in, and all of their motivations so far, at least from the observer's distance, don't seem to be pointing to making a deal quickly, at least not quickly on a Friday.
So let me itemize this. Let me itemize this. We don't know if we're going to get a deal. We don't know what the market reaction is going to be. We don't know if there's going to be a presidential debate tonight. But we do know that George Bush is still the president. Andrea, do I have that about right?
Yes, and we do know that Barack Obama is still going to Oxford, Mississippi.
All right, Andrea Bernstein, thanks for being with us. Todd Zwillich of Capital News Connection, thanks for holding the fort down there in D.C. Todd, thank you.
Ran off to the Capitol, just like he did exactly what you told him to do, John.
Just can't stop Todd Zwillich.
Thanks, guys.
We're always on here at The Takeaway, and Election Day is less than 6 weeks away. Boy, what else can happen, huh? We've got you covered. You'll find our complete coverage on our election website, vote2008.thetakeaway.org.
And tonight, if there is a debate, you can join us online. I'll be live Twittering that first presidential debate, McCain versus Obama, or Obama versus some guy in Oxford, Mississippi that they dragged off the street, along with political director Andrea Bernstein. She'll be Twittering as well. You'll be able to join the conversation on our homepage at thetakeaway.org and on Twitter. That's also Twitter. That's all tonight.
And Andrea writes to us on our website. The Republican says, I'm not voting for McCain, I'm voting for Palin. This is from Andrea Bernstein's report earlier. You get the feeling that a sizable portion of the party would be pleased to have McCain win the election and then kick the bucket. Wow. Leaving the Alaska hockey mom as the leader of the free world.
Well, there's a long time between that notion and the election, and we'll be talking all about it. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Adora Udoji, and this is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway,